That's become the command. They told me during these last weeks. You don't say roll tape anymore. You just say Beulah. And wherever she is, sleeping in her bed, she rises up and rolls a tape somewhere. Can't find a tape in her room. What she does is go down the hall to the bathroom and rolls the tape. Is that right, Beulah?
I know. That she may turn you off. That's right.
This is the last in a series that we've been calling The Beautiful Sacrifice. I'm going to do something I have never done before. This is your kindness, that you give me ears and hearts and souls and an audience, kindly obedient audience, for me to tell a story that is not a story yet. And essentially that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to give you raw experience. That means by raw that I haven't worked it through in any artistic way yet. I will tell you that probably the experience itself will bubble up in writing hereafter. I don't know exactly where. Some of the details you may see 10, 15, 25 years hence. That's what happens. But it was an intensely good experience for me. It was last summer. It was just short of a year ago, August 1988, when I went to the Lakota Sundance on the Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota. One or two preliminary comments, and then all that I'm going to do is walk you through the experience with the hope that my experience partly becomes yours. I will not do much interpretation of the experience. I will just present it to you. But these things I say in advance. I think it fits with our series because it's a kind of a ritualized beautiful sacrifice. In this case, it isn't something necessarily that happens on the fly or, as we say, occasionally, to a particular occasion. This is something that the Lakota do annually. And it is ceremony. It is ritual. It's ritual ceremony. The beauty of which is that it gathers the perceptions of a universe as a people see the universe. Okay, as a people sees the universe. And then it symbolizes it in the action in which they do, in which they perform it. And sacrifice will be part of this. I want to say, let's see here, I gave me several notes. The fact that it is ritual sacrifice, I write here to myself to tell you, is that it doesn't make it untrue or unrealistic. For me, the excitement of ceremony is that it is very much like what art is. Those people who participate in ceremony by instinct learn how they organize the whole universe, all the world. If the same thing happens with us as Christians or whatever your backgrounds are, and the ceremonies that we commit ourselves to, the richer, the more full, the more colorful, the more dramatic they are, the more of the universe and the more of human experience they embrace for us and for our children, so that our children begin by instinct to feel that there is meaning in what happens in their lives, even if they can't always say what the meaning is. Speaking it comes in doctrine, teaching, confirmation, the exegetical use of Scripture. So, if it is ceremony, that does not make it untrue. It makes it the lenses, the spiritual lenses through which we see the world. Am I making sense for you so far? The next thing is that I would like to say that as I experienced this, I felt that I was very much a part of a holy thing. Holy is one word I want, and sacred, and the other is mysterious. If I have any premise apart from this entire series, I would like to offer you now before I present you this story, which may have some disturbing factors in it. I would urge all of you, please, to remember the mystery of humanity. That every human being you meet is a mystery beyond your total comprehension. Now, that's not a bad thing. I don't mean that a bad thing, because we can learn more and more and more about each other. But if we preserve the sense of holy mystery, we will not prejudice each other. We will not prejudge and presume that we know everything about the other person. When we meet a people, we will not presume by our grand experience that we, poor, petty people, know everything about that other people if we maintain the sense of holy mystery. I couldn't help it. I maintained a sense of holy mystery there. It becomes for me a kind of a premise that any time I meet a human, I want to remember that this human is somehow or other shaped in the image of God. And that because that human is in God's image, whether that human acknowledges it or not, that human becomes for me the mystery that I do not immediately comprehend. That makes me humble before that person. It does not make me superior or controlling. It makes me humble and quieter. It makes me wait in a very scriptural way, wait upon that person, not just in terms of service, but in terms of time, to wait upon this mystery to unfold. Every child we have born, we know that. This infant coming into the world is a mystery. But every stranger we meet, we ought to know that, is also a mystery. I hope that makes sense. If you walk away with nothing else from the stuff I've been saying this week, please remember that. I almost weep to tell you, remember the mystery of humanity, please. Because then we will wait, and then we will learn who they are and not presume who they are in advance. As soon as you presume, a wall goes up. You have the happy sense that you understand this person totally. And that person has the sad sense of pure isolation. Okay? So I give you that before I tell you this story, because it is not our tradition. It is not, in many ways, our tradition. But I will tell you that the holy man who ran this, whose name is Elmer Running, is a Roman Catholic. And that many of these who danced in the Sun Dance were Roman Catholic. And that it is not impossible. It is very possible, without a destruction to our Christian principles, to see the goodness of the Lakota perception of the world and to see the harmony between that perception and then also our Christian perception. Oh, I'm saying so much in preliminary. But there is this too, that those peoples who have preserved an intimate relationship with nature probably know our creation accounts better than we do, though they never read them. We have removed ourselves, people. We make our own artificial environments. When it's cold out, we make it warm in. When it's hot out, we make it cool in. We don't know the season through the pores of our skin. Those who remember that still stay very, very close to God Creator, and this is not silly. And this is not excessive or outside of the range of the whole business of the redemption of Jesus Christ. I don't think we know the Christ, except we know the Creator too. And we focused very, very much on what is evanescent and ephemeral. Here I'm going to give you some things that are very concrete. And so I give you the words holy, and I give you the words mysterious, and I say perhaps disturbing, but just wait upon them. Those are my introductory comments.
May I question?
If it's a short one.
Is it incumbent upon me, as a human being, if I encounter you, to help dispel my mystery to you by sharing what is in me?
You mean if you are the mystery and I'm the one who meets you?
By your terms, when you meet
sure.
me, I'm a mystery. Now, do I have a responsibility to help you explore this mystery?
I'm going to answer you briefly, although that's not a short question. That's a long one. And I will say quickly it's a long one so that you don't take an abbreviated answer as the whole answer. I honestly believe there are levels of responsibility, and it depends upon the environment of the encounter. If you and I have some kind of even distant covenant together, then yes, it may be incumbent on you to offer me at least those easy and surface identifications and characteristics that you don't just hide from me. But see, I always often reverse it. I often do. I will tell you, I think it's incumbent upon me to read the mystery of you. I always speak in first. I have to speak in first person. And see, you, most people don't hide as much as they think they do. And now we're off on a whole different topic. But you are readable. The point is, I maintain the mystery so that I can watch how your face moves, how your body moves. Those things are there. It is probably more incumbent upon me to read well and to learn how to read well than it is upon you to deliver all things to me until we establish covenant. As soon as we say that there is something special about, even if that just means we're colleagues who are working side by side in a business, then there is some incumbent, especially if the mystery keeps us without any communication and relationship, then it is. But this fits with my concept of beautiful sacrifice. It is more incumbent upon me to seek. But now if we switch it and you're asking about yourself and I'm the mystery, then it is incumbent upon you to seek. Okay. So now, this is how it began. I was in Minnesota. Some of you may know a woman whose name is Marlene White Rabbit Helgemo. Does anybody? None of you? Ah, good. Luther. There are a few. She's a pastor. She's a Lutheran pastor in Minneapolis. I forget the name of her church. I was speaking there about a book that I have been writing and I'm still writing, which uses the Lakota Indian as the background. And I was using Lakota language, but I'd never heard it. I've always only just read it. I said things like Wakantanka, Onshumaliye, Oyate, Wani Wachincha. And then I interpreted it because it's a very beautiful statement. I did this in front of a large group of people. Wakantanka means holiest, greatest. It's a beautiful term for the deity. Wakan means holy. Tanka means great. Put the two together and you have holiest because of Tanka, but you have greatest because of holy. So it becomes the Holy One, the Holy Great One, the Unnameable One, God. It's a name for God. So the individual who is walking up to the peak, this person is walking to a peak and is probably stripped down to a loincloth and is crying out, Wakantanka, Onshumaliye, Oyate, Wani Wachincha. And translated, that means, oh God, have mercy on me. That's usually where we stop. Kyrie eleison. That's how we say it. Or we just say, have mercy on me. But this phrase, which is a ritual phrase, goes the next step. It says, have mercy on me, and here is where I begin to discover sacrifice in there, that my people may live. And so it is never an individual out for the individual's sake walking across. It's a seeking of a vision. This person who is speaking this phrase is probably involved in a ritual called the Hanblechayapi, which is a going off alone for maybe 3 or 4 days all by yourself. Some of you may recognize this. Without food and without water to seek a vision. But the point is that their purpose for that vision, it isn't just, oh, let me find myself, oh God. It is, let my people live through me. Speak to me. I used that phrase when I said things like I identified the word for grandma, which is the earth too, is Unshi. And I said that the word for grandfather, which is the sky, is Tunkashila. Afterward, Marlene White Rabbit Helgemo came up to me, and the first thing that she said, she's a relatively short woman with a laughing face, with dark eyes. White Rabbit is because she is a Winnebago Indian. Helgemo is because she is married to a Scandinavian. So you put those two things together. With her laughing eyes, this short, round, beautiful woman, glasses, she wears glasses, came up to me, and the first thing that she said was, you pronounce Lakota terrible. I was saying, Tunkashila. She said, it's Tunkashila. Tunkashila. You have to say it that. Tunkashila. And I learned very much how it is exactly that when I went. And then the second thing she said, she narrowed her eyes at me and she said, are you serious? And I didn't know what she was talking about. She said, if you are serious, I will invite you to the Sun Dance that I go to. And I felt very inclined immediately to accept, immediately. She told me, this was when it was still snow on the ground, and she said it's in August, and she gave me the dates, and I had my book, and I looked, and behold, the dates are open. She said, that's God. And that's how she talked constantly. I said, I would like to very much. I've got to talk to Than. We have to work it out with the family. I'm going to be gone a whole lot this summer, but I'd like to. She said, you are invited. I invite you. You stay with me. You stay in my camp. And I need to shorten all this. And so I accepted the invitation, ultimately. I accepted it. It was not easy. It is as though something throws problems in your path. I had no money. I drove out. I had a flat tire. And they busted off a bolt. This is when I was in Evansville. And I was going to drive from Evansville all the way to South Dakota, to Rosebud, South Dakota. And I was going to take 4 or 5 days to do it. I was going to use plastic. And when I went to pay for the tire where they had busted the bolt off, I had no plastic. I had no credit card. I had left it in Canada. And all this meant I kept riding back home again. Than kept saying goodbye, and then I kept coming back again. This was a Sunday afternoon. I was all set. And so I called up Marlene. I said, Marlene, I have no money. She said, I told you that would happen. And she said, you better be there. So I went to my children, and I asked them for cash. That was my money. And I had thought I would sleep in motels all the way. White man, I'm on my way to but I'm going to watch television and HBO and all that kind of stuff. I couldn't. I couldn't. I was reduced to sleeping in the van. I took the back seats out of the van. I said I had to sleep here. And in South Dakota, you know, you can stop in a park and pay for $4, $2 in some place. Very simple parks, but $2. You can't beat that. So I took a lot of food and I put it in the van. I took a few dollars from the kids. I don't even remember if I paid them back. Just now it dawned on me. I don't know if I paid them back. And I drove. I left that Sunday evening and I got as far as Kansas City. And then I slowed down. I wanted to get there on Wednesday when things began, as Marlene told me. She was going to get there Monday or Tuesday. I wanted to get there Wednesday and I took the opportunity. This is significant, I think, to the entire experience. To go the back roads of Iowa and the back roads of South Dakota. And I stopped at every Lutheran church I could find. I had enough time, and I wanted to talk to the pastors. Somehow I felt, because I had the time, I wanted to say, how are you? What's happening? How are you feeling? And it was a curious thing to me that again and again when I would knock on the doors of the church or the parsonage if I could find it. Little towns, it's not hard to find the parsonage. It's either next to the church or it's got a little fish on the door or something like that. They were afraid of me, or they were suspicious, the pastors that I met. What did I really want? And many of them were not ELCA, so they didn't know I wrote a column, so they didn't know, you know, I didn't have that access. I had to just say, well, I'm a pastor from Evansville, Indiana. I just want to see how you're doing. Why? This is important, and this is amazing. I remember that I was driving in the middle afternoon, and I saw a white clapboard church all by itself. There were a few houses back in trees. Trees are always intentional, aren't they, in South Dakota? They're there on purpose. And there was this white clapboard church standing all by itself in the sun in the middle of a field. And I found a road, a dirt road that went back there. And so I wrote and went back. And it was Lutheran. But it was deteriorating. They had one of these neck, you know, where you have a tube comes out over the door and then a bulb, just a plain bulb where flies buzz around and little droppings on that bulb. And the door itself was a bit cracked. And my first thought was that this lonely church was empty, that there was nobody here. And then I went around and, you know, they had the outhouse. And I went around on the side and there was this beautiful sign. They had services every Saturday. I mean, that was neat. There was that sign, and it wasn't empty. It still went on, and they had the name of the pastor underneath there and when the services were and all that kind of stuff was Wisconsin Lutheran Church. Well, I went into the town, and there was another church there, and I knocked on that door. I walked in. It was unlocked. And then it was clear the parsonage was next door. And I remember that I knocked next door, and here came a very suspicious young fellow who had just been out of seminary, I believe, about 2 years. He was in his shorts. I think it was his day off. And I had such pity for his feet. He was barefoot. He had a huge dog. Huge dog with a long, wet tongue. Like that. Which was a very friendly dog. But this fellow stood in the doorway with a screen between us, questioning me why I was there. And so I went through my rigmarole. I just want to know, how are you doing? How is it to minister on the plains? How is it so? And I kept looking. And the reason I pitied his feet is because he had these little, he had a big toe with a little toenail all wrapped around like bread dough with his flesh. I felt sorry for that foot, for that toe. But I couldn't tell him because there was no access to say, you know, I really feel sorry for your feet. So I didn't. It turned out, I have to tell you this, it turned out that he was also the pastor of that little congregation, that white, shining in the sun, clapboard church. And we did begin to talk. He never invited me in, so we talked out on the lawn, and his dog ran, and he whistled it back, and it ran and whistled back. And I felt more than sorry for his toe, I felt sorry for his spirit. Because he had such, distance from that little church. He preached to three places, and that little church, he was upset with them. He said, can you believe it, 16 people on Easter. He said, we got 16 people on Easter, and they like the fact that I'm not really their pastor, they are a preaching post, they don't have to pay anything for my, and he talked about how he gets no money from these people. And he meets them on Saturday night, and that's when they gather, and they will not merge with another church. And so you saw all this stiffness. I felt all this stiffness in him, in these people, if what he was saying was true. Oh, and that night I was alone. That night I went to a little tiny park which had a lake, a blue lake in the midst of green, you know how dark the evergreens can get as they climb little hills in South Dakota. It looked as though God's hand held a lake in the pond. And there was nobody else there at all, like a puddle, like a lake. And so I swam in that lake. I remember what a feeling that was as the sky went amethyst. Absolutely clear. It begins, you know, at a certain point. You watch tonight. It becomes translucent. And it is as though you are looking through a rare stone. And I was all by myself in that lake. All by myself. I could feel the cool water. It was as though I knew my body totally. It was as though, because something is touching every part of my body in that cool water. And the birds would fly over, which to me was beautiful. And the sky was amethyst above me. And I was cupped by the hand of God, which really was dark fur all around me. And then I slept, and the next day I arrived. Well, how you arrive? Marlene says, well, you take this back road, county, it doesn't have the number, it's county 67, you take it south 3 miles, you watch for a dirt road, you got to watch your odometer so that it's 3 miles, 0.3 tenths, you know, like this, and then you turn right, you should be going west, and then you watch for two flags, and then that's Elmer Running's place. You turn in there. I made it. I tooled those dusty roads back and up and down like that. And I remember it was about noon. Here is my road. You come this way and you're way up here. And I remember that I turned right. The two flags are really two white birch poles. And they are various color flags. There's so much to tell you that I will never tell you everything. What the colors mean. The colors mean something. They declare welcome. But you go a little way down this road, and you can see, well, first of all, there's like a hut set up, which is just to keep the sun off the people who are the guards. And the guards ask, they're very big men, and also very kind in their face after you've talked to them. At first, there is watchfulness. This is not a tourist thing. This is a very serious ceremony, which Elmer Running is doing. And they want to make sure that there is no tape recorder coming in here. There is no cameras and Heavenly Days video equipment. Wouldn't have it. This is not to be preserved that way at all. It is to be, and there is a difference between the preservation which takes the picture, which is objectification, and the preservation which is the impress upon your soul. I understood that. So that when I said Marlene White Rabbit invited me, then they were kind, and they put a red streamer on my antenna, so I could come and go as I pleased. That streamer is still there. I never did take that streamer off. But then, as I went past, I looked, and I saw a totally different vision of white. Between where I was, there was a gulch, like a gully. I have to wind down like that, and then there are trees, cottonwood trees, chokecherry, and so forth and so on. And then the path wound up again. And on the hills of Elmer Running's ranch, it was a very, you know, smooth-hilled place, on the hills were the teepees already beginning to be set up. And to me, I had it, and they were white. They were white in the sunlight. And they were so content. That shape to me was such a contentment, not this up and down. I just tell you how I felt. It wasn't the radical up and down square geometric. It was a leaning shape. That's the feeling that I had, that the teepee could lean on the earth and gaze into the sky. That was the feeling that I had with these long poles that came out of the top and the two very long ones that could open or shut the flap at the top for the smoke and so forth and so on and hold the thing up. To me, it was like the peaceful congregation of the gatherings of the peoples when I saw those teepees already beginning. They were already putting them up. Things were going to happen Wednesday afternoon, but I got there at noon first, and I remember that I rode around, and then this is what I saw. I drove down and up this way. This is the way the road comes. This is a low fence. Which encloses a kind of a holy area. And so I drove around this low fence. This is where the cars would park. I went very, very slowly. A beautiful thing happened to me. I met a woman at the gate. I was so nervous. I have to tell you that I was very nervous this whole time because I didn't know the rituals and I didn't know what it would be to be a white person involved in all this. You can imagine how my heart is going. But there was a young black woman dressed in flowing robes that I had seen vacuuming the place where people gather at Lutheran Northwestern Seminary upstairs, outside of where the chapel is. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about. But she had been vacuuming, and this was back in the winter when Marlene invited me. And this woman, as I had walked by, had simply turned and said, I had told a story, and she said, I understand your story. She said, I am Robert. That's all she said. You don't have to know the story. If you know the story, you know what she's saying to me. She said, I am Robert. And I nodded and smiled and departed. She was there. I took that as a sign. She was there at the gate here. And I almost wept. It was a familiar face. She got in next to me, and I said, okay, I'm not altogether alone. So she drove me this far, but she was having her period at that time, which meant that she could not be involved in this. That's part of the ritual. She could dance, but she danced over here at this point with other women in a special place that was done. I will not explain or excuse. I will just tell you what was. And of course, she accepted that. Now, she herself was not Indian. She was black, and she was from Central America. But then she joined us later on, when her period was over. She showed me how to drive around here and come to this. There are various camps scattered all over the hills, but Marlene's camp was immediately south of the circle because she was responsible, she had told me this before, to feed the drummers and the singers, which is a wonderful thing. It gave me a reason for being there because that's what she said, will you help? We made coffee. We made what they called cowboy coffee, right? Which is just the grounds boiled in the water itself. And oh, that's powerful stuff. But that's what the drummers wanted. That's what the singers wanted. They wanted it boiled and boiled and boiled, you know, so that it was so black that if you put your hand in, it would you'd never get that off your fingernails again forever. You wonder what it's doing to the lining of your stomach. Lorenzo, who would sit here, as I will tell you in a minute, and use the microphone and talk throughout the dance, Lorenzo called it the Blue Top Cafe. Because this was blue. We had put up a kind of a tarpaulin on blue. Here was our fireplace. Underneath here we had a bench, and then we had chairs scattered around people. And it was a very nice gathering place. This was Marlene's teepee. I was over here in another one where I slept. But you could get a lot of people in a single teepee, much wider than this here. And you just simply sleep on the ground. So I met them. Not Marlene immediately, but then she came with such freshness of face. And her two daughters were there, and her husband was there. Who burns easily in the sun and has white hair and doesn't dance, but and things began. We gathered, and it was in the afternoon. We had to get the tree. This I should describe this to you, because when I came, this is what I saw. This is the circle. Really, what it is are posts standing up, and there are two rows of posts. And over the top, they put a kind of a canopy so people can stand underneath there and be shaded from the sun. This is the circle in which they dance. At this end, they actually enclose the sides so that the dancers, when they rest, come back in here and rest here. This is facing due east. This is Elmer's wife's grave. She had just died the year before, and they put it in the perfect eastward direction from the center of the circle on. And when the dance had begun, they said, "You cannot cross here." One would say, "Well, how far can you go before you get around?" And they would say, "Infinity. You cannot cross here, because this is the beginning of the contact, or this is the beginning of at least the recognition of the harmony of what we are and what all of God's creation is." But people who watch the dance, this is the low fence, the cars would park here, and then people could walk in here, not here, you don't cross here, you'll have to go all the way around. So there is a sense, you see, of orientation. You know what the word orient means? It means eastward. There's a sense of orientation with all the directions. And so we walked around. But there was a hole here. There was just a big hole, more than 7 feet deep in the center of this circle when I came. These are the sweat lodges. I drew them back here. There were five of them. The men would use these sweat lodges. The women would use these. In Elmer Running's dance, the women and the men dance together. There are some new things happening, even among the Indians, that the men and the women dance together. And I'll have a word to say about that as we go, as I began to discover it. This is fire. This is fire. This is a deep pit. And the flames from that fire can leap very, very high. And in the night, I can understand how the Europeans coming over and seeing something like the sweat lodge with the fires. The fire is to heat the stones, which will be brought into the sweat lodge, upon which the water is poured to steam the inside of the... I can see how the Europeans would say, "Savage." Because I have seen at night, when the flames leapt very, very high, what they called the firemen. That's what they called them. The firemen worked to get the rocks out. First of all with a shovel and then with antlers. I have seen them look almost like my child's image of what an Indian would be with the flames leaping all around them. Although at this point on Wednesday the fires were not burning. There were teepees here of the dancers, although dancers could stay anyway. Marlene danced and she stayed out here. all right. Wednesday afternoon, it began. We gathered in a circle. It was a relatively small circle, and Wednesday there were not that many people. And it was Lorenzo got on his microphone and prayed in Lakota, none of which I understood. And then we got into a long line of cars. We went to get the tree. And that's when I began to realize that every gesture is identified. The tree was marked a long time ago. It must be a cottonwood, a tall, tall cottonwood. And it must be cut down with an axe, not with anything mechanical. And the first two people, we got there, we went down through the woods. Now there's a lot of woods. We left our cars and our trucks up there, and they led us to where, Elmer Running going first, led us to where the tree was, and I saw that it had to have flag tied around it. It was a very large tree like this. And the ritual has, first of all, a young child, a girl, should take a swing. And everybody stands around and watches. And there's a deep sense of community at this point where the children participate. Where the children participate from the very beginning. And so this beautiful little girl, almond eyes, she gets this huge axe. You know, she's trying to, and everyone's smiling at her. And she goes, nip. That's it. She got her little, and then here comes this little boy. Takes the axe, and he goes, whew! And everybody, whoa, like that. You could hear the, he missed. And then all of a sudden he was a humble little boy. Nip, like that. And then there was this most handsome man who, as a matter of fact, is a stuntman in the films. A young man with long black hair, which he wore sometime in braids and which he wore simply bound and falling, cascading over his shoulders. You see, it was the dancers who would cut that tree down with the axe, and he was one of the dancers. And he was one of the praised children of this whole area that he had gone off to Hollywood and made big. In fact, I have to tell you, if I can remember the name of the guy who was his friend, who was an actor who was there, just kind of sitting back, and no one paid a whole lot of attention. He Kris Kristofferson came there, and they're good friends together, and no one made a big deal about it. I mean, the word would go around at night, Kris Kristofferson is here. I had a hard time picking out who he was, till, you know, blonde. Right. Well, anyway, I wanted to tell you how beautiful this was while we stood there, because this man, I wish I had his name, I don't have his name for you, began to swing the axe into the tree with so much power in the whole upper torso. But every time he took a swing, his hair would fly around his head. His hair would fly wild around his head. It made my heart just leap. And I was beginning to enjoy that when they said, "We need help. We need help to catch the tree." All this stuff is new for me. Catch the tree. Yes, this tree should never touch the ground. It should not. And so immediately, men started breaking posts about this tall, and they should have some strength in them. And then what we did was, one on each end of the posts, we made a ladder out from the tree. We're going to catch this tree, which is a huge tree. It's got a big trunk, and then it has this wild explosion of branches at the top. It's a beautiful tree, the cottonwood, with its kind of silvery leaves on it that constantly shimmer when they call it the whispering tree. So we're lining up like this, and there's a little bush to the left here like that, and they're all talking as we're hearing chop, chop. Can't see it anymore because we're far back to catch this tree. Can't let it... Whoa. See, I'm nervous now. At first, I was looking around for poison ivy. I didn't want it. Now I'm looking up for the tree. And you see it sway. It's a giant in the air. And there is this faith that it is living. You see it sway like that. And then all of a sudden, the people who are in front of you say, "Well, it's going to hit that bush. It's going to bounce over here. Let's move over here." Whole ladder moved over like this. And when the tree came, it sheared that bush. It did not bounce over. So what happened was, it was coming not for my, it was coming for me. And I have to confess to you, I took a deer leap. Dropped my pole. The man in front of me didn't budge. Just stood there, because it was the branches coming down. That was the branches on us. And the branches came whoom, around him, and he was still standing. Crap back. I really didn't. You know, I'm sweating. Am I holy? Do I belong here? I'm scared of this stuff. We stood. Now I have to shorten. But we stood 30, 40 minutes while they walked up the tree, while the dancers walked up to the tree and trimmed it up to a certain point so that we had a clean trunk at, I'd say, 35 feet up. A clean trunk, 35, 40 feet up. And then we had to carry that tree we carried it up to a truck, and we laid it. You know, we laid it over the cab of the truck, all the way out the back of the truck. It should never touch the ground. And but we got it there. It took a long, long time to adjust it. We didn't tie it. People stood on either side and held it. Precious thing, you understand. That's why you don't have mechanical. There is a precious relationship between that tree now, which is representative of the totality of nature, which becomes almost sacramental, is the word that we would use Lutheran if we would make these kind of parallels, because it becomes somehow or other the representation of the presence of Wakantanka or God among them. And so there is this delicate, very gentle thing that says, we will hold this tree, as huge as it is, we will keep it from the ground until it gets to its resting place. And so we drove, and I was in the Helgamo van as we were driving, and I remember somebody in that van saying to Marlene, do women pierce? And almost in an enigmatic way, she said, yes. I don't think she meant to be, but that's how it felt to me. Everything took on triple and yes. And the person who was asking said, yes, but how do they pierce? And she answered, oh, they have a way. So you live in patience, mystery. You live in patience to find out, what does all this mean? What did you just hear? We walked the tree back. We stopped the truck here, and we literally slid the tree off on those posts that I was telling you about. And we walked along here. At this point, everybody started taking their shoes off. Because when you enter here, it's always without shoes. And then we brought the tree around. It came in trunk first. And we entered into this place. And then we laid the tree down, not on the ground, but on the posts that we had been carrying so that it didn't touch the ground. And its base was here, and then it came to its branches out here like this, which stood up high. Lorenzo said, everyone stay back. Lorenzo said, let the dancers go first. And then I saw the dancers with great dignity, male and female, walk in and begin to tie around the trunk of the tree little, it was like necklaces with each pouch full of tobacco that they had done. They've been picking, by the way, sage wherever they go. And wherever they pick sage from the ground, they leave a gift of tobacco. There is never any taking without giving. And the little tobacco, so then they tied it around, and it was bright, beautiful little pouches, red, blue, green, so forth and so on. And then, first of all, Elmer Running went here and he tied four figures, which I won't take down, four figures among the branches. And then at a word, everybody converged. And two things happened. Those who were dancers came in with ropes. They were plastic ropes of bright color. And they tied their ropes around the base of the tree like this. And then they spread them out. And it was a beautiful sight. They spread the ropes out from the tree like this. And I began to think of wings lying on the ground. And then a lot of people, mostly women, brought bright rags, beautiful bright cloth, expensive linen cloth, and tied it in the branches of the tree. Some pieces this long, some pieces short, but festooned that tree while it was on the ground. And then they said, we need help lifting the tree. There was a strong wind. There was a strong wind blowing north, because I remember it was coming from this way to this way. They said, we need help lifting the tree. And I noticed that the dancers were all standing at the ends of their ropes, and that their ropes divided into two, and there were two loops. So I went standing next to a dancer like this and waited for the dancer to give me one of those loops. Very kind man. He said, no, I don't think that's what he means. I think he means push the trunk up. I said, okay. So I stood in here underneath. The dancers fanned out like that, and then there came a cry, and I, who had seen the tree come down to me like this, whoa, saw that tree go up. I never imagined that both of those motions can have beauty in them and meaning. But I stood here, and then at a cry from Lorenzo, this tree heaved and swept up, and those who were carrying, pulling their ropes fanned around it like this, so that first they pulled it up. We pushed. We went pushing like that until it was too high for us. And I just saw that thing leap into the sky. And it did look, and the wind was still. True. It was absolutely still the entire time. And once it was up, and once it went thump down into that hole, that 7-foot hole, then all the dancers fanned around it, and Lorenzo would cry out, north, and these dancers would pull a little bit, and the tree would be brought up, and he'd cry, south, and they'd pull, and until it was perfectly straight up. It was a wonderful thing to see, that fan of colored ropes all coming down like that. And then we were bidden to stand back along here. And then they held it, and it was windless for at least a half an hour while people shoveled dirt in around the base of the tree to make it solid.
and it was beautiful. Up in the sky was this festooned color of all the streaming. What the cloth was a kind of a declaration. I want to be very careful, as Marlene talked to me, to say that the cloths themselves were not prayers. But the cloths were the declaration, I am praying. There's a difference. I am praying, and I am praying high unto thee, Wakantanka, O God. The people, some of them who would dance, some of them who would not dance. And then we stood and we prayed, and then the dancers, when we were all done, they bound their ropes up and let them hang from the tree so that it looked like the tree wore a dress, wore a kind of a dress of hanging ropes, and the bundle of rope at the bottom was always just high enough that a man could reach and loosen it and bring it down when the time came. And so we were done with Wednesday. Marlene said, Walt, are you going to sweat? And by that time I understood what the word meant. She meant, was I going to enter into one of those lodges, you know, with a grand fire on the outside and where they put rocks in? And people had told me, they said, when you sweat and they pour that water on those stones, which are red hot stones, you be sure you bow your head between your knees, because when the heat hits you in the face, it could sear your nostrils. Marlene said, Walt, are you going to sweat? I said, oh, probably tomorrow. Friday. I was nervous. I admit to you my nervousness. I didn't know. And Marlene couldn't go with me because they made that division. And Lorenzo. And Lorenzo was an old man with a huge belly. You'd call it in Lakota, Tetsi Tonka. Tetsi Tonka. Big bellies, the big bellies. Who loved to sit back in one of those chairs. He had a big old nose. He had a big nose and he was balding back like that. And little tiny eyes, laughing eyes. And he would love to tell stories. He'd love to tell stories of the past. Old man who had been going to sun dances. You know that the sun dances were outlawed for many, many years. And he went anyway, because they had them anyway. There never was a time they did not have the sun dance. They had them anyway. And I want to tell you that Lorenzo said over and over again when he took the microphone and when he met me, this is what he said. He was talking to people like me, of which there were more than just me. He said, when you entered that gate, you became our brother. When you entered that gate, you became our sister. That's what he said. And I looked at the whiteness of the teepees, the whiteness which paralleled the whiteness of the clapboard Lutheran church on the plains, but which was so easy on the sides of the hills. And he said, when you entered there, you were, and I didn't believe it. I mean, I believed it. I didn't believe it. I was still nervous. I didn't believe the kindness that truly, truly had welcomed me into this ceremony. Elmer Running had made a decision several years back. He said, people are learning the pipe across the world, and they are interested in it. Better they should learn it right than that we should tell them nothing at all. So his is open to people like me, very, very carefully. And as I told you, he is Roman Catholic, and a practicing Roman Catholic. He worships in a church called St. Francis nearby. And very wise, I think, because nearby there is another holy man who absolutely refuses to let any Anglo or European or black in, because he's preserving, that holy man is preserving the culture. Yet here Lorenzo said, when you entered, you became our brother. When you entered, you became our sister. No, I did not sweat that night. The next morning was Thursday morning, and the dance began before the dawn. Before the dawn, Lorenzo got on that microphone. I was wide awake. And he sang. He sang a little song, and I didn't know. You know, I thought, oh, holy ritual right away. It was a joke. There is so much humor going on there. He sang a little joke in Lakota, and I heard all these little titters from throughout the camp, and I was all set to pray. And then he made jokes about waking up, and it was an hour before the dawn. It was an hour before the sunrise, and he did that because the dancers had to rise and sweat in preparation and dress. And so I remember that just as the eastern sky had that kind of swollen gray to it, you know, that looks like it's about to pop when the sun is about to come, then the drummers began to drum. This is where they sit. Here is a drum. Here is a drum. When they had a lot of people, they would trade off. But at the beginning, there was only one drum team, and there could be anywhere from 3 to 6 people. And they all sang the same song. And you've got to see the way in which they did it. The drum sits on the ground in its own cradle, and each one brings his own drum stick, and then they hit with all their might, but the rhythm is constant. It never changes. It's boom, 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 boom. And when they sing, they throw back their heads, hey, real loud, and just pitch themselves into it, pitch them. But it's words, and all the people know those songs. Lorenzo knows so many songs, and people are afraid that when Lorenzo dies, many songs will die with him. That's a true fear that they have. And Lorenzo bears that responsibility lightly, I am amazed. So he's been teaching people songs as they are willing to learn, but they're afraid they're going to lose those songs. They sing them strongly. So I remember Before the Dawn, I heard that boom, 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 and I came out down into here. By the way, in case you're wondering, the outhouse is here, and it only has three sides. Well, you have to, so there are two holes, and the open part faces south so that you can watch the sun watch you. And there is no, the dancers do not drink nor touch water the entire 4 days of their dance. They can drink other fluids, but they can't drink water. It heightens the consciousness of what water is at the same time, I suppose. I remember that I came out having looked south for a little bit and came in here and stood underneath the canopy. There were very few of us at that point, but then I saw the dancers come. Oh, Lord, I wish I had a long time to tell you this. There's so much. They danced from back here, and they danced around this side so that they could enter from the east. And just at the moment that the first dancer, which was Elmer Running, who was an old man, and he had his own step, but you know there's a kind of a universal step, I think, among the Indian. You will recognize it all the time. But his was a slow step. Just as he entered, with a line of dancers behind him, the sun came at the horizon. What a music! You know, that's what Beethoven tried to do. Beethoven tried to make the right sounds meet at the right place at the right time. And here is a music. This is what the medieval people talked about when they talked about the harmony of the spheres. They meant that the spheres in harmony above the sublunar filthy sin of this earth, where there was no sin, were so much in harmony that were you up there, you would hear the harmony like music. So this is not a terribly foreign notion. It's one that we have moved somewhat away from. The moment that he entered, the sun breasted the horizon and shot darts across his wife's grave and caught them. And they danced in here, and the men wore skirts of bright colors, sometimes with signs on. The people were barefoot, unless there was something, there's very careful, unless a person had trouble with the feet and he'd get blisters on there, and then they would be allowed to wear moccasins. They wore sage wristlets and anklets. They carried a hawk or an eagle wing feather. They had in their teeth whistles made out of eagle bone. And there is the counterpoint to the drum. I thought this would be deadening, just boom, 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 but it isn't. There are many ways to make rhythm. So what you'd hear is boom, boom. But various people are playing various counterpoints, and that beeping whistle goes on and on and on. And they got this thing sticking out of their mouth as they came around past me. Here, this is, they always, always go clockwise, which is called sunwise, not clockwise. They always go, and so they came, and everybody had a pipe made out of the pipestone. And what they were doing then was dancing in the very first dance of the day, and here was considered an altar upon which each person laid their pipe, the pipe already filled with tobacco on the way through, and then they went into a dance that was beautiful. No, the dance itself does not circle. Each one will take up a position that creates a circle, and then stand and dance within that position, and then the drama all happens as they face inward. The first round, which is always the same round in every morning, can take 45 minutes, hour and a half, as the sun comes up and as the day begins to warm. And it would be the same song throughout. For an hour and a half, the same song, over and over and over again. And I never caught the variations of rhythm, but they all knew it. First of all, when they had finally come around like that, they, as it were, closed the gates. And those who were leaders would come. You always would grab the sticking out part of the wristlet of somebody that you were going to lead around. And a leader would come here, and they would close the gates by putting young women dancing forever in each gate that says, nobody can come through here now. It is closed. It is unto a kind of a sacred thing. And each woman wore a different color compared to the position where she was standing. If I remember correctly, it would be west. Well, no, I'm not even going to try to tell you. If I think, I can get the right colors, but I'm not going to try. Yellow was east. I believe green was south. Red was north. Here, I'm trying to do it anyway. Anyway, she would stand and dance there, and every time they would come to a pause, they would acknowledge the four directions before they stood still and they danced. So there was a sense of joy, there was a sense of community, there was a sense of all kinds of things happening that were meaningful, and I didn't feel that I had to know them, and at first I simply sat on the ground and watched, but as the day went on, I saw these old, old ladies with such lines in their face, they looked like maps. Or, you know, if you push it like that, it would just stay, and then very slowly you go, doo, 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 and all the wrinkles would come down again like that. I saw those old ladies get up and shuffle and dance the whole dance through underneath the canopy as well. And then they would make a circle. At a shift in rhythm, everybody would move in toward the tree, but they would go at various speeds. The young ones would shoot in, bam, 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 and the old ones, very dignified, slow, and let all the other ones, and then you come and you honor or reverence the tree, touch. And then you back off, always dancing in this way and backing off this way, and then the slow ones would come in at the very, beautiful, beautiful. I'm not giving you at all the details. The second round, they rested back in here a little bit then, and Lorenzo came up and drank black coffee. And the other drum beater, they came up and they laughed among themselves, and it was a wonderful thing that they had such you. Lorenzo would sometimes, while they were dancing, he'd say, "At the Blue Top Cafe, steak." And you see, the dancers can't eat. Oh, and such coffee we're having now. And he would do that to tweak them. You know, there's that constant humor. And there was the same thing about children. Children, I think, children are very much a part of this and not denied. Although I didn't see anyone dancing who was younger than maybe 9 years old who would dance. Now, I want to tell you the second round when they came out after they had done the rest and they came around to set it up once again. There's so many things to tell. But I noticed that one elderly man had taken the rope from the tree and unbound it and brought it out this far so that it was coming like from about 30 feet up and brought it out and staked it in the ground, which I didn't understand. And then when they danced out again, I saw, after the gates had been closed, I saw the leaders come to that man who had very thin skin, and I saw that he had a circle in red that was painted on his chest. He had white hair, and it was bound up behind him like this. He looked like a vigorous old man, but an old man where the skin begins to sag a little bit and where the pectoral muscles are a bit flattened and sagging. A little round, not a tetsitanka, but a little bit round tire there. And they danced him around the entire place, and he honored each of the directions. And then they brought him into the tree, and still dancing, he bowed, honored against the tree, and then he lay down on the blanket, the buffalo skin blanket that was there. And I didn't see what they were doing, but I saw that they had brought the rope in. And when he stood up, I saw that what they had done was to take something, bone, plastic, and to pierce him through the skin like this here. So that it came out over here and then on this side as well. And they tied his rope ends to these two piercings. And I just went like that. I was like, I stopped breathing at that moment when I saw that. There were just two tears of blood that came down. Do you know how in the effigies of the Christ upon the cross, such as in Spain, they will draw like two drips of blood down? I used to think that was just stylized. It's not. That's real. That's how it happens. Two drips of blood, and then they stop, and then you get a line. And this man, then he reverenced the tree, and then at a certain point, he danced backward with everyone. He danced backward and until that rope pulled out and until the skin pulled from his chest like that, and he leaned back against it, still dancing. And then pretty soon, people gathered behind him with their eagle wings, and they were beeping their whistles, and they would slap him with the eagle wings, which I think I understood meant for strength and for community and all that kind of stuff. Once he went in with the others and he reverenced the tree, and then he danced back again, and he pulled against that twice. The same thing happened three times, and on the fourth time I felt a difference in the air. I truly felt a difference in the air. I was standing now, and I found that my feet had begun to do some of the same motions as I was beginning to dance. On the fourth time, the man went in and reverenced the tree. And this time when he backed up, he bicycled very fast. He went faster and faster and faster backward like that. And at the very last instant, I heard two sounds at the same time. I heard him go, like that. And then I heard this flesh snap. It was like a wet sound. It went, pew! And I saw the rope shoot to the top of the tree like that. And he did it. He did a spin like this in the air, and he was grinning. He was smiling. And then the fellow who had first brought him around grabbed hold of it, and this time he came around a second time and reverenced each of, and I saw that what he had done was literally break the skin to break that rope free. He had pierced himself. This is what piercing was. And now he danced around the whole thing itself. Danced around, smiling. And I had seen what was not uncommon. Every time someone would come out with those circles drawn on their chest, it was for piercing. Or sometimes they would have them drawn on their back, and I saw one strong man. What they would do is pierce the skin on the back and then connect it to buffalo skulls, 6 buffalo skulls in a row, so that this individual would dance sunwise, pulling the buffalo skulls behind him with a whole train of people that are supportive. But if it didn't break, they would begin to turn the buffalo skulls over so that the horns would begin to plow the earth until it would break. And Marlene and I, we sat and we talked about that piercing. And what does that mean? And she said, well, let me add one thing. So that evening, there was a woman who pierced. And I don't know why she had been so enigmatic about it. But the woman did not pierce the chest. The woman pierced the arm. And this woman had decided that she would not break the pierce for 2 days, which meant that she would stay within the circle day and night, praying, crying. And it was announced, Marlene told me, because she knew this woman, and incidentally this woman was married at the very end of this whole ceremony. The woman had 3 brothers, all of whom were alcoholics. She was praying for her brothers. And this is what Marlene and I began to talk about, that every one of those people who chose to do a piercing were praying for something, but it was almost never themselves. It was this woman praying for her 3 brothers, an alcoholic. Now, Marlene said that, of course, some people will think that the more pain they get, the stronger is their prayer. But she said, Elmer does not say that. She said, we do not say that. What the piercing is participation. What the piercing is participation. And my mind shot backward through our fasts, which are the participation and the awareness of our corporeal body. The ways in which we ourselves, in our own past, have used spiritual devices to become very, very sensitive to our participation with Jesus Christ, our participation with the people who are pain. We know that when we fast and do not eat for a while, if some of you choose to do such a thing, that our fasting is no good work that changes things, but we know at the same time that it is sympathos. It's a beautiful word, sympathy. It is empathos. It means to suffer with. It means the sharing in the suffering. And that somehow or other our prayer becomes the sharing with the person for whom we are praying. 3 brothers who are drunk, but it also becomes a sharing with the deity at the same time. And it really is only just a pleading that the deity would be that one. But it is ritual, and please let me say it as clearly as I can. This is how I understand it. It is that the piercing merely defines the quality of the prayer. It doesn't empower the prayer, it doesn't make it works righteousness, but as Marlene understands it, it defines what kind of prayer we are praying. We are praying the prayer of sympathy. We are saying, I know, I dwell within my brother's heart. And I enter my brother's heart with the wisdom to see that he is really killing himself. He doesn't have that wisdom. Oh, Wakantanka, have mercy on me that my people may live. That evening, when Marlene and I were talking, there came a most beautiful, I can't say boy because he was older than a boy, he was, I would say, 28 or 29, and he looked very, very sad to me. His name was Florentine. He was thin, and he had a blade of a nose and dark, dark eyes and long, coal black hair that went straight down his back. He was sitting next to Marlene, and he had the ability of gesture that would almost nuzzle her, almost cuddle up to her. And Marlene introduced me, said, this is Walt, this is Florentine, and we smiled and shook hands with one another, and I felt an instant rapport with him. She said, Florentine is not dancing because his grandmother died 3 months ago and he is still grieving for his grandmother, so Florentine is not dancing. We all wish he would, she said. Florentine just hung his head. And then she talked of other things. She said, you must know, she said, Florentine is an artist, and she was right. He is an artist of rugs and blankets, and it isn't that he makes specific shapes, it is that he knows the value of color. And as he puts color together, he can create mood. I tell you because I saw it, mood and emotion. He can make the purples and the greens and the blues speak and comfort you. He can make the reds and the oranges and the vibrant pinks assault you. He is an artist. And he smiled, and she said, and Walt is a writer, and he smiled. Obviously, my art was nothing to his art. And then he left. And then she told me, sadly, she said that his grandmother was the one whom he has cared for years. That he really has been his grandmother's staff and stay. That he used to throw great parties for her. Very careful parties where all the people would come and he'd make gifts. And now she's dead and he's alone. And so he's very sad he's not dancing. That night, I sweat. Twice! Because the first time I went, I finally enticed a fellow who was a very quiet man. He was an Indian, but he was from California, so he was not much part of the whole Lakota tradition. But he was there kind of learning and seeking, so he's very quiet, very lean. He had high cheekbones. I liked him. And I said, would you go with me? I don't know what to do. Yes, he said. So we went, and we entered into the sweat. You have to enter here. And you enter then clockwise on your hands and knees because it's a hovel, only this, it's made out of buffalo skin. It's absolutely enclosed. The fires are going. There was a light rain that night. There was a light pattering rain which felt cool. I did not strip naked. I stayed, you had the choice. You could wear your trunks. I wore my trunks. But many of the men would go in with a towel, you see, and then also be naked for whatever that is. And then we would go around, and as you enter, you say, Metakweasan. Metakweasan, which means all my relatives, and can mean various things. It means I'm going to pray now for all my relatives, or it means all of you here are my relatives. It's a wonderful, embracing thing. Or else it means all that is my relatives, a declaration of faith, if you will. And we enter, and then this fellow was sitting next to me, and they always have this joke about a warrior sweat. I wish they wouldn't do that. Well, because it's, I want a warrior sweat, a lot of stones. And I'm sitting here looking at that fire and these people leaping, and it's dark out at night. And so they bring the stones in, and they put them into a little hole dug in the ground. You're sitting around your toes right there. And the first sweat was 7 stones. They brought in 7 red-hot stones, and then they put a little sage on which sparkles and crackles, and a little cedar, and that makes a sweet smell on the inside, and then they close the thing. And they sing, first of all. Oh, they sing loud. You think singing in a bathroom is loud. Get in one of those things where no sound goes out, and they won't see anything. See, that's where it comes. I always heard that grandfather name. Like that. On my ear, and you can see the whoa, whoa, whoa of the stones in the middle like that. You're curling your toes back because you know that your toe hairs have all just crisped. You pour the water on it, and it brings the steam up, and then there's an opportunity. I'm making it very simple because the first sweat was very simple. There's an opportunity for each person to pray, either in Lakota or English or whatever, and you say that you're done praying with a Metakweasan. If it gets too hot, you can say Metakweasan, and they'll let you out. And that happens sometimes, true. But I was thinking to my, I really did sweat. When the water hit it, I had my head, and I planned on just breathing very slowly through my nose and just a little through my mouth like that and all that. I was being very scientific and mechanical. And within a half an hour, that sweat was done. I said, I made it. I'm not done. We came out, and it was very dark. The fires were there, but there was nobody else around there at all. And the fellow who was with me came out very gloomy. He said, that was no sweat. He said, I'm going to wait. He said, do you want to wait with me? And all my heart started going, blah, 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 blah. That was no sweat. I really sweat. It was cold. I mean, put a little chipmunk under my arm, have a shower. About a half an hour, we sat in the light rain, which did feel good. And then all of a sudden, this young dancer came, this young, vigorous dancer. By the way, you know you're old. When your dentist and your lawyer and your doctor are all younger than you, probing in the private parts. Well, this is almost like the dentist, the doctor, and the lawyer coming in the form of a Lakota Indian. What are you all waiting for? They said. And my friend, who was tall and very quiet, said to Sweat, well, let's go, he said. And this was a vigorous fellow with a frown on his face. He went charging in and around. We kind of followed patter, patter, patter after him. And then men materialized out of nowhere. So we filled that whole place up. And they started saying things like, warrior sweat.